So now next we'll come on to Dave McAllister, who's going to speak about the question as well. Thanks, Dave. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Roger. Thank you very much for that, Kirsten. I think one thing it highlighted, and it's the most important thing to remember about the conflict in Yemen, is you look at who suffers the most, absolutely, but you look at who benefits. And that sheds a really sharp light on what's happening here and Britain's role in it. Now, the one thing I want to say, first of all, about Britain's relationship with Saudi Arabia, it exposes the real interests behind actually a lot of what Britain's done and the United States in the region around the so-called the war on terror, which, as everyone knows, has been sold time and time again as some kind of humanitarian civilizing mission about human rights, women's liberation and all the rest of it. The Saudi regime is in the powerful position it's in, able to bomb Yemen with impunity because of the backing it gets from our own government. And this is a regime that's got an absolutely appalling record on human rights on pretty much every register. So that's where you have to have as your starting point in terms of looking at what where the interests lie and why we're supplying arms to Saudi Arabia. As Kirsten's mentioned about Yemen, what we've basically got is the biggest humanitarian crisis anywhere in the world right now. COVID-19 has made it worse, but it's not created the crisis. I mean, we talk about how in this country and in others around the world, coronavirus hasn't so much created injustices and inequalities, but it's rather turned up the volume on them. It's intensified them. And you look at the corporate, political, imperial elites, they've made it very clear where their interests lie. In terms of not locking down properly and privatizing healthcare and PPE, all the rest of it, make it very clear where their interests lie, even if it means catastrophe for the majority in society. Now, this is just as true, if not even truer, in the case of countries torn apart by war and bombing, such as Yemen. We could talk about how different governments have handled the crisis better than others, depending on their health services, how good welfare state they have, how wealth is distributed or not distributed. But in Yemen, the situation is so dire that whatever government they have been left without any resources to deal with the COVID-19 crisis at all. Another snapshot of what's going on. 80% of people in Yemen need some kind of humanitarian assistance. It's difficult to comprehend. We're talking about 4/5 of the population are down as needing some kind of humanitarian assistance. 8 million Yemeni children are not in school in any form of education. 2 million under fives are malnourished. Now, think about that for a second. That has a very, very long-term impact. When you consider, I'm a teacher myself, when you consider the stunted physical and cognitive development that will result from that, lower life expectancy. So the massacre that's going on in Yemen now, it'll have a ruinous effect on future generations of Yemenis as well as the current population. There was a report on July the 20th in 113 regions across Yemen, which reports that 40% of the population are food insecure. Literally, they don't have enough to eat day to day. Cholera and diarrhea, which has been mentioned, wholly preventable diseases, which we tend to associate with the 19th century in this country, are absolutely tearing through Yemen because of the destruction of its infrastructure, its medical services, not enough clean water, entirely preventable diseases. Food production, as I've heard, is reduced by around 50% every year. The £2.5 million demanded by the UN, only half of that was pledged. So the situation in Yemen is absolutely dire beyond comprehension. None of this has happened by accident. This is not sometimes what you often hear about the Arab region conflicts is that some kind of product of some ancient historical conflict within the Muslim world. It goes back centuries. It's got little to do with us. I think in the anti-war movement, we have to absolutely reject that wars happen and deliberately continued as a result of political decisions because it suits someone's interests. As Kirsten Beer said, with the arms companies involved, BAE Systems, and the lavish dinners that they're able to enjoy as a result of the profits from that. So these wars happen because it protects one section of society as opposed to the majority, and because someone will profit from arms sales. There's a long history of this. Again, Kirsten mentioned the colonial legacy going back through the 20th century after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire and after World War One, the European superpowers, Britain and France at the time, moved in. They literally drew the lines on the map. They created the region in their own image, in their own interests, in the aftermath of World War One, where huge reserves of oil were discovered there. There was the founding of Israel in 1948. Ever since then, Palestine has lost more and more land. Britain has continued to be not just complicit, but a supporter of the ethnic cleansing that's been ongoing in Palestine. It's interfered time and time again alongside the US in country after country, often with regimes that were democratically elected. The one people in this meeting may know about was Iran in 1953, where Mohammad Mossadegh was overthrown. He was a left-wing nationalist. He was overthrown, replaced with the Shah, who governed Iran with brutality for over 20 years. And then you have the war on terror. Now, Saudi Arabia is very much within that picture, turning a blind eye to their own human rights abuses, rolling out the red carpet for the Saudi royals. Since 2016, UK arms sales to the Saudi regime have risen fivefold. These include cluster bombs that have been dropped over Yemen. And cluster bombs, by the way, have been prohibited by Britain and 100 other countries. Apparently, this doesn't extend to selling them to clients abroad, including Saudi Arabia. £5.4 billion worth of arms have been sold to Saudi Arabia to fund a war which has killed 100,000 people. Kirsten again mentioned the resuming of arms sales during the summer. Within days of that, civilians in Yemen were hit with a Saudi airstrike. In August, 9 children were killed in another Saudi strike, and that was a fourth in 2 months to cause multiple civilian casualties. And this is despite the British government's insistence that Saudi Arabia is not engaged in the regular bombing of civilians. So there's an absolute conspiracy of silence around this, and it's very underreported in the media. Likewise, hundreds of Saudi military personnel received training at Royal Air Force bases in the UK and in 2019. And MI5 is training spies from Saudi Arabia and a host of other repressive regimes in the region. So this is a disgrace, not just a disgrace, but it's a British disgrace. This is something that Britain is absolutely a key player in. And this is, as I say, all very much within a tradition of British imperialism as the world's main colonial superpower before World War II, then after World War II as a junior partner to the United States. However, we have a different tradition, one which comes from outside of the establishment, and that is the tradition of protest and anti-war and anti-imperialist politics. A standard defence often used, and you can apply this to the nuclear weapons, which are costing upwards of $200 billion, a standard defence of all this by Western governments of this immoral policy of arms sales is that it's good for jobs. It has the support of workers because their jobs depend on the arms trade and the supply chain that comes from it. But in Canada, Spain, France and Italy, workers opposed to the war have organised and refused to load weapons onto ships which are sailing to Saudi Arabia. So workers have actually organised and used their own organisational strength to say, no, we are not going to play a part in this. Our government can do what they want. We are not part of this. And this is the kind of action that we need to be supporting, as well as the campaign work of other organisations involved with Stop the War. In recent years, myself, I first came into political activism in the mid-2000s as a student through the anti-war movement. This was at the height of the War on Terror, and this was the anti-war movement, the biggest mass movement in British history, and this culminated in February 2003, a demonstration of 2 million people around Britain, 36 million around the world, the biggest day of mass protest in human history. Now, because that war went on regardless in Iraq, I feel sometimes people downplay or forget the impact that that movement has had over the longer term. I remember in 2003 when the decision to bomb Syria was voted down in Parliament, the legacy of the anti-war movement hung over that, and it hangs over our government still. And it has created, as well as the Iraq war being a disaster, it's created a reluctance to go to war amongst the political elites. Interestingly enough, there was a conversation between one MP and Jeremy Corbyn before he became Labour Party leader, and he said, you know, Jeremy, if only we'd listened to you over Iraq. And he was like, well, there were 2 million of us on the streets, you know, it wasn't just me. You know, your own constituents were telling you not to go to war, and you still did. So the reason I highlight that is to say that the legacy of that movement has been still very, very powerful. As we've seen, even during the crisis we've had with coronavirus, there's been 3 protests in London, some of them that Kirsten mentioned before. And it was the legacy long-term of those mass movements that actually, I think, propelled Corbyn to the leadership of the Labour Party. The anti-war movements always had alliances with people on the left of Labour, even at the height of Tony Blair when he was strutting the stage. But the long-term impact of the anti-war movement had a huge impact on the popularity of Corbyn when he was standing for Labour leader. A lot of the people that flocked into the Labour Party were people who'd come into politics, like myself, through the anti-war movement. Now, since then, there's obviously been a change of management, as the saying goes, in Labour. And Keir Starmer, he is on record criticising the arms sales to Saudi Arabia. But I think what's even clearer since he's become leader, he's on a mission to basically remove the anti-war legacy of the Corbyn project, the sacking of members, the ramping up the witch hunts around solidarity with Palestine and all the rest of it. I'm not looking really to Starmer as someone who's going to lead the way on this at all. It comes down to the mass movement, and it's been proved time and time again in the past, the organised workers. We're living in a society at the minute where workers are getting involved in unions and starting to organise. Now, when we make arguments for the kind of society we want to see, that has to include our own priorities militarily, the militarism of the British establishment. This isn't just about international solidarity with Yemenis, although that should be at the forefront. But it isn't, and it never was with anti-war politics. The brutal and militaristic foreign policy of the British state is directly tied to domestic issues. Why, for example, are we paying upwards of $2 billion on Trident when over 4 million children are in poverty? How much of the literally trillions of pounds wasted in the war on terror could have gone to preserving a properly publicly funded health service, state education, or green jobs? Think of what a better position we would be in to deal with the coronavirus crisis, and what a better position Yemen would be in were it not for the wastage of that war. This is not just about money. This is not just about how much money there is. It's about what we do with it, about what we do with what we have. And I'll finish with a quote by the late Tony Benn, former president of Stop the War Coalition. If you can find money to kill people, you can find money to help people. So I'll leave it there. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Dave. And that concludes two very powerful presentations. And like, thank you both for those presentations. And we'll now go on to the discussion. And if you want to ask Kirsten or Dave questions, those presentations do leave us with a lot of hope for the future when we hear about what Campaign Against Arms Trade is doing, and also the positive note from Stop the War. Just to say also, the National Steering Committee of Stop the War did discuss this question just last week, there are regular activities and actions, and there's a meeting this week, and an international meeting on Yemen on Thursday, which I'll give the details of later.